afternoon, and welcome to Open Air, KALW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts here in the Bay Area. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. This week, playwright Patricia Milton and composer Caroline Altman will talk about their original musical comedy, Moments of Truth, being staged by Three Girls Theater Company. Mugwumpin co-founders Christopher White and Joe Estlack talk about their two-man takedown of the Hollywood disaster film genre at the Intersection for the Arts. Smiwin Ballet's artistic director Celia Fuchil shares details about the dance company's new season. And Anne Randolph talks about her acclaimed solo show Loveland, which returns to the Marsh. Plus, arts contributor Diane Keough with an update on cultural offerings on the peninsula. Stay with us. That's music by Julia Kent from the world premiere dance work by Smiwin Ballet's choreographer in residence, Amy Seiwert, Broken Open. One of the offerings on Smiwin Ballet's tour of the Bay Area in their vibrant new program, Dance Series 1. This program features two world premiere dances, and in addition to Amy Seiwert's Broken Open, another exciting addition by current Smiwin dancer Ben Needham Wood, entitled Maslow. Also enlivening the program will be the return of Ma Kong's French Twist, a fast and flirtatious work inspired by the American cartoon Tom and Jerry. And rounding out the program, founder Michael Smiwin's lyrical Bouquet, set to a pair of glorious Shostakovich piano concerti. With me in the studio to talk about this tour and their upcoming performances here in San Francisco at the Palace of Fine Arts next weekend is Celia Fuchil. She's been artistic director since 2007 of Smiwin and a very important visionary in increasing the reputation of this premier contemporary American ballet company. Before acting as artistic director, Celia was Smiwin's first dancer and appeared on stages in the U.S. and Europe, on television and in film. And as artistic director, she expanded the repertoire of the company by commissioning some 13 premieres and adding the work of renowned choreographers while maintaining Michael Smiwin's legacy. She also served as executive director of the company for a number of years. Celia, welcome back to Open Air.
Thank you, David. Great to be here.
It sounds like a really interesting program that this weekend is down in Mountain View. Let's talk about some of the works that are being presented.
Well, we thought it was a good time to revive Ma Kong's French Twist. It seems that every year since I've been involved with the company, we see the dancers' technique improving, and with stronger and stronger dancers technically, Ma's work requires incredible precision and speed, and it's great to see the dancers tackle that. It opens the program. It's a work that is not on point. It was originally created in workshop at the National Choreographers Initiative.
Let's NCI. Back up just a moment for those that aren't ballet savvy. On point, talk to us what that means.
So the female dancers are not dancing on their toes. Normally in classical ballet, the women will dance on their toes. This particular work, as is frequent in contemporary ballet, you're seeing soft shoes like the men generally do wear. We don't usually have the men on point unless we're talking about the ballet Trocadero, where the men will then be on point when they're dressed as women.
And then some.
Right. Exactly. But in a classical, a contemporary ballet company, you may have some works that are on the toes and some that are not.
I was going to say, because Smuin often has a variety of dance types that are going on.
Exactly, exactly. And I think that because the dancers are so versatile and have this broad range of styles under their belt, they tackle any style with such finesse, and it's fantastic to see how they're dancing French twist now. Very dynamic work, very fast-paced, and it's tremendous. Ma Kong was in the studio himself working with us for 4 days after our ballet master, Amy London, staged the ballet, and he was just delighted to see the dancers working as they are. So interesting, too, that he brought in elements not only of classical ballet, but also he trained at the Beijing Dance Academy, and you see some elements of Chinese traditional dance in there, with sometimes the hands are more flat, with the fingers in line with the hands and not with soft hands that you see generally in classical ballet, and some things that are also in parallel with the legs moving in parallel, instead of everything in classical ballet is generally turned out from the hips. So it's really an interesting combination of things, and I'm just thrilled with how the dancers are performing it. Mm-hmm.
We opened with music of Julia Kent for Amy Seiwert's work. Amy is the choreographer in residence. Tell us a little bit about her experience as choreographer in residence.
Well, Amy danced with the company for 9 years. Michael had hired her from the Sacramento Ballet, and she had already started choreographing, but he really took her under his wing in terms of encouraging her in that way. He really felt that she had a unique voice, choreographically speaking. And after Michael's passing, Amy danced for one more season, at which time I named her choreographer in residence. She was already creating some smaller works on the company. And I think this is number 10 or 11 for the company, and it's just delightful to see what she's done. Amy is very thoughtful and very careful in how she constructs her ballets. She came into it with an unusual process, too, because she was working on movement samples without music for the dancers. So it wasn't until about the third day of rehearsal that she actually started showing them the music that she was planning to use. I was not familiar with Julia Kent's music when she started talking about using this, and she sent me some of the tracks, and it was just spectacular. It's beautiful, rich strings. The other exciting thing is that some of the music hasn't even been recorded on CD. So when we asked the composer for permission to use her music, she and Amy were in a direct dialogue, and she was sending Amy tracks before they've even been released on CD. We wouldn't be able to get a CD in time. So she was actually in direct communication with the composer, which was pretty thrilling. And she was thrilled knowing that this choreographer in San Francisco was using her music. And so after working on some movement phrases, then Amy started putting some of the, showing the dancers some of the music. And so they filled out these very rich phrases, and it's a breathtaking work.
Nice. So Broken Open, what is that, and what is the meaning behind the title there?
I should probably let Amy answer that, but she likes to leave it open to the audience. There are the different things that inspired her, and one of the things was seeing a woman who had had a horrendous double mastectomy and was left with this scar, and something that could be so perhaps ugly. She had this tattoo made over it, and it turned into this thing of beauty, and that if we break something open, we might see the inner beauty of something. And so this was just one of the things that inspired her.
Maybe you could share with us what we'll see on stage then for Broken Open.
The dancers are in, the ladies are just in leotards, so they look like one-piece bathing suits. So you really see the body in motion in this. I often think of Amy's work as sculpture in motion, and this is really evident in this as well. Very interesting pairings, and some of the dancers exit traditionally through the wings to the sides, but there are also entrances directly upstage at the back of the stage, and they come in and out of this world that Amy's created. It's spectacular and really fitting these lush strings of Julia Kent's music.
And how wonderful that you're taking this as a world premiere on the tour. Another world premiere is happening by one of the current Smeon Ballet dancers, Ben Needham Wood. Tell us about his work.
This is Ben's third year with the company, and in the 2 years that he's danced with Smeon, he's shown a real ability as well in choreography. We have at Smeon Ballet a choreography showcase where the dancers have an opportunity to create on one another, and it was pretty thrilling to see Ben's ability to create works. He's also a very thoughtful, introspective young man, and he indeed tackles the subject of Abraham Maslow, the psychology of the philosophies of Maslow, and self-actualization, and really being the best that you can be, tackles the five elements of the psyche. So it's a short work, but very deep. Ben also has a quite varied background, not only in classical ballet, but also in a little bit of hip-hop. And he brings some very unusual elements. And thrilling, too, that he collaborated with a friend of his who's also a composer by the name of Ben Soli. He's a cellist, and Ben knew him from Louisville, where Ben used to dance at Louisville Ballet, and they had worked together once before. So it was thrilling that this music was composed for Ben for his first premiere with Smeon Ballet.
Lovely. You mentioned Ma Kong's French Twist. We have a brief excerpt of some of the music of Hugh LeBar. For that, what are we going to see on stage as we hear this wonderful music?
You know, it's interesting when you Hugh LeBar did do a lot of music, a lot of it's cinematic. He did do a lot of work for animation, and so you can imagine those fast cartoon figures zipping around the stage and making quick abrupt changes in movement. And we see a little bit of that in this ballet as well. It's for eight dancers. Four men and four women. High-paced opener.
Here's some music of Hugh LeBar, Escalier, that's featured in Ma Kong's French Twist. Then another few minutes with Celia Fouchil. From Hugh LeBar, part of the Tom and Jerry-esque Ma Kong French Twist that will be performed as part of the Smeon Ballet's romp through the Bay Area there at the Mountain View Center for the Performing Arts on Castor Street in Mountain View this weekend. And then next weekend, they come back home to the Palace of Fine Arts here in San Francisco for performances October 1st through the 4th. Celia Fouchil, thank you so much for coming on today to share a little bit about the wonderful Smeon. We're going to look forward, of course, to the Christmas presentation that is a highlight of the Bay Area as well.
Thank you. Yes, we'll be coming back to theaters around the Bay Area for our 20th anniversary of the Christmas Ballet.
Thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you, David.
Of course. Well, the play's the thing for the balance of this week's open air. Well, a musical or two thrown in as well, with offerings from the Intersection for the Arts, an original musical comedy, Moments of Truth, and a spoof of the disaster movie genre, courtesy of Mugwumpin. And next, the... Let me see if I can get this right. Return of Anne Randolph. Not a disaster at all for two offerings at the Marsh, Loveland and Inappropriate in All the Right Ways, which is an alternative, actually an interactive creative workshop that retraces her various life journeys to share her life's lessons now through the 1st of November. Anne's journey includes being an Ovation Award-winning playwright and performer. She was named San Francisco Examiner's Best Solo Performer in San Francisco in 2010. Her multi-character solo show Squeezebox was originally produced by Mel Brooks and the late Anne Bancroft and went on to become a critically acclaimed off-Broadway hit. Anne has also contributed personal essays to NPR, The Weekend America, as well as the BBC, as well as a number of TV and film appearances. Welcome, Anne, to Open Air.
Thank you for having me.
Of course. Well, let's start with Loveland, which we'll then talk about the interactive aspect of Inappropriate in All the Right Ways. Who are the characters that we'll meet in Loveland?
Loveland, the main character is this kind of oddball, sexually repressed misfit named Franny Potts, who's on an airplane ride to go back to deal with the death of her mother. And she's completely inappropriate. In fact, the headline the Washington Post review put was Inappropriate in All the Right Ways, which is how the second show came to be. But it's her way of dealing with loss, and it's a story that really... And then I play all the characters. I play my mother. I play the people on the plane, everybody that's having to deal with this woman that is in grief. And it's outrageously funny, and it's also very deep. And afterwards, the audience actually wants to speak about loss. So it becomes an interactive thing as well, where the audience writes about loss and then takes the stage and speaks about it, whether it be heartbreak, divorce, anything. It's a beautiful experience that happens right after the show as well.
So are all the characters and the situations completely autobiographical, or is there a little bit of artistic license thrown in
there? There's artistic license. There's embellishment, which I love. Because of comedy with humor, and I love playing the characters who are really funny.
Well, let's back up a little bit to your collaboration with Mel Brooks and Anne Bancroft, who were your producers for Squeezebox, and they make a reappearance in Inappropriate in a certain way.
Yes, they do.
What was it like working with them?
It was incredible, because one thing I was surprised, because at the time I was working this homeless shelter job at 7 at night and 7 in the morning, and I was making $8 an hour, and then I was working with Mel and Anne. They had to option my piece, so the stakes for Broadway. So it's like, are they really going to do it, or am I going to stay at the shelter? So it was like this thing from Homeless Shelter Broadway, I remember. But they were so patient. My show at the time was 2 hours and 20 minutes, and they wanted it to get to New York at 80 minutes. So I'd literally go over to Mel's house, and they'd help me craft that piece, edit that piece. And so I was with the masters for like a year.
Oh, my gosh.
And Mel's like, get rid of the joke, focus on humanity, you know? There was a lot of comedy in there, but the fact that he would say, always focus on the story, the humanity of the piece, rather than go for the joke.
Even though that's fascinating.
Yes.
It's interesting to see.
Yeah, they were incredible, incredible mentors to have.
And that Squeezebox was at the Marsh when?
That was, I want to say, 2007 or 8. Yes.
So they make a reappearance as part of this Inappropriate in All the Right Ways. In what way? As part of your life's journey?
Yeah, as part of my life journey and working with them and what that was like to be in their world and to study with them, and the heartbreak that also occurred after Anne's death, which was right around the time of the show opened in New York, not long afterwards. So there's a lot of, once again, that Inappropriate in All the Right Ways is funny, but it's also dealing with resiliency and moving through loss as well.
So how does the audience become interactively involved in Inappropriate? Is it during the presentation? Is it after?
It's after the presentation. I want to say to anybody out there, you don't have to participate, but everybody ends up participating. But you still always have the option. So this idea that, once again, they write about their life, they write about loss, and then how one moves through loss and recognizing that we all are affected by loss, but it's how we move through it and what helps us to move through it. And I believe sharing of stories helps us move through it. So that's what happens. The audience begins to share their stories afterwards.
Mm-hmm. And the Inappropriate in All the Right Ways will be on Sunday afternoons at 2 o'clock, and Loveland on Saturday afternoons at 5.
Yes. Yes.
So where is home for you now?
I'm a nomad.
I'm proud of it.
Yes. I literally go wherever the show goes. So I will plant down for a while in a place where the show is. And so, like, I was at the Arena Stage in Washington, D.C. I was there for 3 months. And then here in San Francisco for 3 months. And then I'll go to Kauai. I lead a lot of workshops at Esalen and Kauai and around the country doing my show in tandem with workshops. Uh-huh. So pretty much 3 months Kauai, 3 months Big Sur, Esalen,
and San Francisco.
For those that aren't familiar with Esalen, share with us what you do in the Esalen workshops.
It's called a Write Your Life workshop, and teaching people to speak the unspeakable, the things they're afraid to speak about, and to put it up, just be witnessed, be heard with things that you're trying to hide. I think the path through truth runs through shame, and we're running around all the time trying to cover up all these things. I'm like, let it out, let it rip, you know? And I think these shows that I do, let it rip, there's nothing holds bar. I mean, I'm actually having sex on stage in Loveland. So
okay.
Anyway, there you go. But anyway.
It's a family show.
It's a family show. No, it's rated R. But, it, you know, it's what you do in grief. What do you do in grief? You eat, you have sex. What do you do in order to move through loss? Mm-hmm. So, anyway,
so
teaching people to speak about the things that are, you know, very vulnerable and hard to speak about.
And it's and you're doing it in a way that's not all just tears and angst.
It's your, no, it's outrageous humor.
I was going to say, it's very funny stuff.
It's wild humor. And I think the humor, it's kind of a sneaky approach. You know, you get people laughing and then all of a sudden the heart is opening up and people are being moved.
Mm-hmm. And Randolph is in Loveland and Inappropriate in All the Right Ways at The Marsh through the 1st of November. Information at themarsh.org. And what's next for you? Where are you? Where is this nomad's life taking you?
Well, the nomad's life after here, I go to Kauai, and then after that,
that's
back to
be tough.
Esalen. I know, it's really hard.
Sympathy votes here. You're not going to get from this audience.
And now Barcelona, of all places. They want Loveland.
All right, that's enough. Get out of here.
I know, I got to go.
Get out
okay,
of my studio.
Okay, I'm going
studio.
To Barcelona. Ah.
Get out of my studio. Here. Nice talking with you.
You too.
We'll see you again soon. And maybe I'll come to one of those workshops. That's it.
Why don't you?
I'll do that.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, moving on to some other musical comedy, folks. Moments of Truth. It's a original music and lyrics by Caroline Altman and a book by Patricia Milton. It's being presented by Three Girls Theater Company, the world premiere of which. It has a subtitle, Everything's Sketchy When It Comes to the Truth. With musical direction by the great Scrumbly Coldwoon. It's at the Royce Gallery on Mariposa Street between Alabama and Harrison through the 18th of October, having opened last Saturday. Playwright Patricia Milton's plays have been seen here in the Bay Area at the Exploratorium and Piano Fight and in the San Francisco Theater Festival, Women's Will Playfest, San Francisco SF Fringe Festival, and Scheherazade. Among other groups, she's active with Theater Bay Area, City Light Source Writers Group, the Central Works Writers Workshop, Playwrights Center of San Francisco, International Center for Women Playwrights, and others, and is resident playwright of Three Girls Theater Company. She was last here in February to talk about her comedy, Enemies Foreign and Domestic. Welcome back, Patricia.
Thanks so much, David.
And composer Caroline Altman is also a singer, actor, director, educator, lyricist, and founding artistic director of Lyrica Bella Productions. Her award-winning musicals include Whiskers! Exclamation mark, the musical of the Velveteen Rabbit, Kiss the Frog, and the operatic anti-bullying touring show, How Andy Found His Voice. Local credits include featured roles with TheaterWorks, 42nd Street Moon, and Cal Shakes, among others, and have garnered her a SF Bay Area Theater Critics Circle Award and a Shelley Award for contribution to the performing arts. Welcome to you, Caroline.
Thank you so much, David.
Well, let's start with playwright Patricia Milton. Give us a brief synopsis, if you would, of Moments of Truth.
Well, Moments of Truth is a comedy about a couple of fine arts painter and her collaborator, a shock art photographer, who decide to collaborate to revive their failing careers. And the project that they choose is called Moments of Truth. They decide to photograph subjects using a lie detector and capture the moment of truth during their session. And what happens throughout the course of the play is that one of the artists wonders if perhaps she should bring the lie detector into her relationship.
Oh, I think that's a mistake, personally, myself. So why a musical?
Well, the thing that we, Caroline and I both love the musical theater genre. And the thing that's so great about a musical is that you can express, for example, if you have artists, you can express things like artistic joy, You can express sorrow and joy in a relationship and so forth through music. And it just adds another dimension. It's so much more inspirational, joyful. It brings additional emotions to the audience that regular drama or comedy cannot.
I'd have to agree with that. Very good. Now, does the inspiration for Moments of Truth come from personal experience, perhaps?
Well, I think it's part of the human experience that we can never actually use an external source to understand if people are being truthful with us. So we can read body language, we can trust, we can go on past behavior, but in the end, it's always an internal, we have to rely on our own internal beliefs as to whether or not someone is lying to us or telling the truth. And the yearning for some kind of external way to know this, I think, is maybe something that people can identify with.
All right, then, since you are now hooked up to headphones that are also hooked in the other room to a lie, do you have any personal experience with a lie detector test?
I don't. Well, what was interesting is when I was interested in doing a lot of research on this, I did find there is an artist who uses a lie detector on her subjects. And actually, her name is Paulette Phillips, and her art is the squiggly lines that come out of the lie detector. And she frames those, and that's what's displayed in the gallery. So I thought that was very interesting that someone had apparently beat us to it.
And now, Caroline, tell the truth.
I'm going to do my best.
Have you ever had any experience with a lie detector test?
I haven't.
Proper?
No. Well, and I hope not to, honestly.
Okay. Officers, you can leave now. That's fine. Thank you very much. So was a real lie detector being used as a prop, or is it just a prop?
Actually, it is not a real lie detector. We invented a very compact and super streamlined lie detector. They're actually these giant machines. And so we decided that a more portable lie detector would be ideal for this performance.
So what are we going to see on stage? There are four characters, five?
There are four actors. One of the actors, Douglas Georges, plays all of the models. And so it's actually really a lot of fun to see him transform from one character to another. And the models that these two women decide to use are actually people in the community, friends of the leading character, which makes for some very awkward moments. So, for example, when her reverend appears as one of the models, it becomes extremely awkward. TMI, as it were.
I guess so. That's Patricia Milton, who wrote the book for Moments of Truth, being presented by Three Girls Theater Company. It's a world premiere. Also with original music and lyrics by Caroline Altman, who is here. Caroline, I'm wondering what your inspiration in terms of musical theater has been. What influences might we hear in your music?
Well, I actually think of this score as being fairly eclectic. While my most of my experience is in earlier musical theater, I'm a big fan of Cole Porter, Jerome Kern, George Gershwin, on into the 60s probably. And so often I will write music that has that old school feel. With this show, I'd say that there's much more of a modern feel to a lot of the music. And the reason that I say it's eclectic is that one of the things that Patricia and I were really working towards was creating very multi-dimensional characters that were different from one another. And so I feel like the feel of a specific song needs to fit what the character is like. So, for instance, our two leading ladies, Nan and Chloe, Nan is an impressionist artist, and Chloe is more of a shock artist. And so you'll notice that Chloe's music has a little bit more commercial a sound, a little bit more of a pop feel to it, whereas Nan's music tends to be a little bit more lyrical and impressionist, and really has some dream elements to it. And then in between them, we never want to talk about this story as being a love triangle, but there are elements of that. Nan's husband, Gerald, is when he sings, he also has a poetic lyricism to his songs, which allows us to really see the connection that he has with Nan. And so I would say that you run the gamut from sort of a pop song to real commercial sound to old-fashioned Rodgers and Hammerstein type feel, and then into cartoon type music. And there's some folk elements, and there's also, you'll hear a little bit of classical elements in there as well.
Nice. You've got some wonderful musical direction by Scrumbly.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what's it been like working with him? Has he offered some suggestions here and there for how this the overall work should be shaped?
He's fantastic, and I couldn't think of a better musical collaborator to work with on this project. Yes, and he, of course, has such a strong understanding of all the genres that we touch upon in the music of this piece, and so, you know, it's like it's a kind of a shorthand conversation with him when I say, well, I'm kind of thinking a little bit more, you know, Lady Be Good here. And he says, oh, yeah, okay, great, got it. You know, or I'm going a little bit more in this direction, you know, a pop element here. And can you do, I mean, Patricia can attest to the fact in rehearsal, I'll say something like, what if we end it with a ba-da-da-dum-ba-ba? And he'll say, oh, got it. Okay, great.
Here's a button. You
know, yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Add a button to it. Nice, nice. Patricia, I'm wondering if you can tell me a little bit about 3G Girls, Three Girls Theater Company and its unique mission.
Sure. So, I mean, sometimes we are called 3GT for short, but Three Girls Theater Company is a five-year-old theater company, and our mission is to develop, promote, and produce plays by women playwrights. And there is kind of a need for that. Nationwide, there's about 20% of the plays that are produced are by women. And
what I found fascinating about that statistic is that it's the same as it was about a century ago.
You know, also about that statistic, it's 20% all over the place. So it's 20% in Congress, and it's 20% women in upper management in corporations. So the fact of the matter is, I think they did a study where if you're in a group of people and there's 20% women and you ask them how many women are in this group, they'll say 50%.
Interesting.
So it's just kind of an unconscious thing that's going on. Anyway, so Three Girls, you know, we're not interested in the politics of it, but we are interested in putting women's work out there. And over the past 5 years, we've put the work of dozens of women's plays out into the public. And so we're really excited about that.
Mm-hmm. Caroline, is this your first experience with Three Girls?
This project is. We've done a series of readings of, actually, that's not true. We also, Patricia and I wrote another musical with Andrew Black that we also did called Not Without Our Women a few years ago. And we did a reading with Three Girls for that musical. And then we did three different readings of Moments of Truth. So this is the first project that's really come to fruition where I've worked with this company, and
nice.
It's been fabulous.
Nice. I mentioned in your introduction that you won a Shelley Award. I'm not familiar with the Shelleys. What is your Shelley Award?
That is for, it's Walnut Creek, actually. It's for the East Bay Theater.
Okay, great.
And
great.
That community out there, mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, circling back to Moments of Truth, I know that a musical takes a lot to birth. It must go through a lot of incarnations, a lot of workshops. How did this one grow and start?
That's absolutely true. I would say musical, you have so many layers. You have a collaboration, which means we can't really make a lot of moves without each other. It wouldn't make any sense. The characters have to be developed together, so that's just takes time. And as Caroline mentioned, we had three different readings with Three Girls Theater, and we rewrote in between. And actually, as we were getting ready for this particular production, we tackled some of the really, really tough kind of remaining scenes that we knew we needed to get in shape. And the ending was one part of it. The endings are always hard. And we were able to come up with a really satisfactory ending that we're very proud of. So we tackled all the hard stuff really to get it ready for production.
And what a sort of, we have a piano excerpt from the show. Is that what we're going to hear if we go to the show? Is it accompanied by piano? Or?
Yes.
Great. And tell us about this work that the brief excerpt that we have at the ready here.
Okay, this is actually from, we made a CD back in one of the early incarnations of the show, and this is Nan singing. It's really the crux of her problem at the beginning. She has been not received successfully. Her art has not been received successfully, and she's also doubting the loyalty in her marriage. And so in this excerpt, you'll hear her figuring at first she blames external factors, that the whole industry has gone in a terrible direction. And then she says, oh, wait, no, maybe I've lost track of who I am.
The music of Caroline Altman from the original work, Moments of Truth. Caroline, Patricia, thanks so much for coming in today, and wish you a very pleasant run at the Three Girls Theater.
Thanks, David.
Thank you.
Art's moved on, now it's commercial pap, forced emotion and consumer crap. I took the road less traveled by when I was in that wood. Now I have fallen off the map. I've fallen off the... What if it's me? What if it's suddenly me? Sunshine streaming, filtered by the clouds. I can paint that. I can paint that. 17, the moonlight on the waters. Very first glimpse of the dark deepness of soul and emotion. I can paint that. 20. Just a bit heartbroken, looking at the many layers of landscape in my view. I can paint that. Oh, how I paint that. Now at 42, I can't find the proper hue. Where is the picture? Where is the view? Light is gone. The deep freeze in me has been turned on. The sketch I made so long ago of how my life would bloom seems leached of all its color, and I'm in an empty room. Inside an empty
That is composer Caroline Altman singing from her Moments of Truth original musical comedy. It's at the Three Girls Theater Company, being presented at the Royce Gallery on Mariposa Street, which is between Alabama and Harrison Streets, through the 18th of October, having opened last Saturday. Information at threegirlstheater.org. Good afternoon. David LaTulipe with you for Open Air, our weekly performing arts magazine. Well, last week we had the executive director of Intersection for the Arts, Randy Rollison, on, and he mentioned as part of the 50th anniversary offerings was the group Mugwumpin, which presents Blockbuster Season, a furious, darkly hilarious critique of media representations of disasters. After previews tomorrow and Saturday, it opens officially on Sunday evening at Intersection for the Arts on 925 Mission Street, and as I mentioned, runs through the 18th of October. Joe Estlack and Chris White are two of the original founders of Mugwumpin, and they join me in studio today. Chris is a theater artist, puppeteer, musician, writer, and co-founder and artistic director of Mugwumpin. Around San Francisco, Chris originated the role of Lance in Richard Montoya's The River with Campo Santo and played a featured role in Montoya's film The Other Barrio. He played Simon Stimson in Shotgun Player's recent acclaimed production of Our Town. At SF Playhouse, he designed puppets and directed puppetry for the West Coast premiere of David Greenspan and Stephen Merritt's musical adaptation of Coraline. For a time, he was play director in residence at Project Arts Center in Dublin, Ireland, and also directed with various Dublin companies. Welcome back, I believe, Chris. We have talked before.
It's true.
Good to see you.
Good to see you too, David.
Joe Estlack has collaborated on every Mugwumpin show since the company's inception in 2003. He was last seen in the terrific Stupid Effing Bird at SF Playhouse, where he was also seen and heard in Jerusalem and Promises, Promises, another great show they're doing. He's also been seen in productions for Boxcar Theater, Shotgun Players at Ashby Stage, as well as Magic Theater and the Aurora Theater. Joe, welcome to Open Air.
Thank you for having me.
Well, this show sounds like an awful lot of fun, spoofing the whole disaster movie genre. What happens in this play, or more likely question, what doesn't happen in this play?
Yeah, it's it is a very intense 65-minute show in which there is a lot of destruction and mayhem of an imaginary city called Champlona, which we sort of imagine as maybe a cross between Vancouver and San Francisco, maybe. At least that's how it exists in my mind. Joe, is that what you see in your mind?
Yeah, actually. I don't know that we actually talked about that, but Vancouver and San Francisco.
Yeah. That sounds... And it gets destroyed in all kinds of ways. It's kind of like the Kenny of cities from South Park. It just keeps getting destroyed and coming back again and getting destroyed and coming back again.
So how are you representing this in a theater setting?
Yeah, well, I think that was really one of our challenges, to have a show that's essentially two people. It's mostly me and Joe performing the show, and then there's a third performer who takes on the role of sort of the camera operator. There's a lot of live video feed happening throughout the show that sort of reframes what's happening in the show on projected screens and gives us a different view, a sort of more media-centered view of what's happening. And it was a real challenge for us to figure out, okay, how do we represent all of these different scenes of destruction in a way that's really simple and theatrical, because that's sort of one of Mugwumpin's trademarks, I think, is to create really magical images in as sort of poor means as we can. So there's nothing on stage for most of the show except for two chairs and a bunch of pieces of lumber.
Okay. Yeah, and a lot of that inspiration, I think, comes from directly from our training, because Chris and I train together, and a lot of the challenges that excite us are physicalizing spaces that aren't there, using only our bodies.
So where did you guys meet and work together?
We studied together at Naropa University at an MFA program there that no longer exists. After we did the program, it moved to London and became the London International School of the Performing Arts, which does still exist. It's an amazing training program that's based in the pedagogy of Jacques Lecoq, who theater fans might know. He sort of is one of the main teachers of devised theater and physical theater, and people like Julie Taymor came out of his training. A lot of really renowned companies came out of his training.
Interesting that we can say on the air Jacques Lecoq, but we can't say stupid effing bird.
Exactly.
Yeah, his name gets a lot of flack.
So, Joe, do you prefer the whole musical situation, the stuff you've done at SF Playhouse and on the musical front, or do you like doing straight comedy? What floats your boat the most?
I love it all, it's all challenging. I've been doing this work with Chris for a while, and I feel like I've been away from it from a little bit for a couple years at least. We've been working on the show here and there in workshop phases, and it's just exciting to be back with Chris collaborating in this way, generating like raw material and putting these puzzle pieces together. But it's all great.
We should say that actually Mugwumpin creates all of our work from scratch. We don't start with a script or anything like that. So everything that you see us perform, we created in the rehearsal studio. We do a bunch of research before we start creating a show and bring all of that research in. This was a lot of fun to research because we just got to watch a lot of terrible disaster movies. And, especially in the early portion, we would come in with, oh, my God, I transcribed this scene from Volcano, and it's ridiculous. Wait till you hear it.
Or some of Charlton Heston's dialogue from Towering Inferno.
Oh, yeah.
Hope made it into it.
There's a lot of that, yeah.
And I think the thing that excites me about this piece and the work Chris and I have been doing is that we really focus on a logic of the body. So we improvise, and that's a way that we write our material, by improvising, and we follow what sort of nourishes our bodies and what comes next. And later we get pretty analytical about it, but it's really impulsive and spontaneous.
And you mentioned that there's all kinds of elements coming in from all this research you've done, the fun research. The challenge must be making it more concise, bringing it down to a manageable size.
Yeah, it's funny. Actually, right before we came into the studio, we were trying to write captions for some of our promo photos, and it became very difficult for us to take these images that are very clear and are very recognizable from different disaster movies and also real-world disaster situations, but they're essentialized into sort of a poetic form where we take everything and make it quite concise, and we conflate images and layer and overlap things that then once we try to articulate it into just a simple sentence, it sort of defies articulation. So yeah, it's something that I really encourage people, obviously, to come and see, because there's just such a visceral experience in watching the show.
Now, I'm kind of feeling like we're all overdue here for some sort of a disaster. I'm wondering if some personal experience has come into the creation of this work. What have you guys survived through or been scared by, for that matter, in your own lives?
I think the thing that feels most immediate to me is just the recent fires going on in California. There's been some areas in California that I have a lot of personal experience with over the past 10 years that they've been brutally affected. And that was when it got a little more real for me. You know, like when you have a lot of experience in that area and you see it totally demolished, it was different. And that taught me that I had to
maybe
appreciate
think about preparedness a little bit more.
Well, that and just appreciate our material in a different way.
Mm. Yeah.
How about you, Chris?
Well, I think about growing up on the East Coast, and I remember, I think I was maybe 8 years old when Hurricane Gloria hit. Mm. And I remember it just happened that my parents were away on vacation, had left us with a woman who turned out to be quite a bit more religious, shall we say, than my family was growing up. And while she was hiding under the dining room table, just praying to be delivered through the disaster, my brother and I, who were just children, were running around taping up the windows and, you know, tying down stuff outside so it wouldn't blow through our house. And that's something that I come back to pretty often is, you know, my brother and I really having at a young age to pull it together and prepare the house for this incoming storm.
Mm, interesting. I'm thinking back to my earlier comment about how we're really due for something here. I mean, it's not a question of if, but a matter of when. Yep. And thinking of the influx of younger people into the Bay Area that have no knowledge of even having been woken up at night by a rumble. Mm-hmm. So I'm wondering what the reaction is going to be in a full-on situation where we get some kind of a big quake going on.
I think that part of our hope with this piece is to really get people thinking about how they would react and thinking about approaching the idea of disaster in a different way than how movies train us to think about disaster. I mean, I was just thinking about the movie Pacific Rim, which was one of the main inspirations for this show.
I haven't caught it yet. Okay.
I don't know that I recommend
it. Wouldn't bother. I couldn't finish it.
There's a, you know, one of these rousing speeches in the show. And poor Idris Elba, who's a fantastic actor.
Way too good for that movie.
Yeah. he has to say something about, we've chosen not just to believe in ourselves, but believe in each other. And it's such an ironic line because it's really the opposite of what disaster movies train us for. They train us to think we can't believe in each other. We have to believe in an Idris Elba type hero to lead us through the disaster.
Yeah, yeah.
When in actuality, we really have to be looking to our neighbors and our communities, because ultimately, really the first responders are going to be the people who live next door to
us. Yeah. And to be honest, usually often a hero much whiter than Idris Elba.
Yeah, in the movies, often the case.
So for the most part, this is in good fun, but you're also looking at with a critical eye at some of the reaction to from major figures.
I would say that there's
past disasters.
Yeah.
Real life disasters, not just Hollywood.
Exactly. There's a deep and sometimes hidden, but sometimes pretty overt undercurrent of political consideration under the entire show. I mean, there are moments during the piece where audience members will probably think to themselves, wait, I've heard that somewhere before. And often that'll be from speeches given by our leaders during times of disaster, be it Katrina or 9/11 or Sandy.
I was going to say, I could probably, you know, give you some material from after 9/11 with Giuliani in New York. It was ripe for material for both satire and faint praise.
There's a little of that in there you may recognize.
Man, yeah, and I would say that most of the text in the show, some of it is originally written, and then some of it's taken from movies and from president's speeches and stuff. But it's all treated with the same amount of respect, I would say. We're not doing one thing tongue-in-cheek and the other. So it's all sort of honored in the same way.
Yeah,
so
there's a real effort to take things out of their original context so that people can hear them anew and hear them in a different way and bring a critical eye to them. And hopefully I think that we're achieving that in a lot of moments.
That's Chris White with Joe Estlack. They are Mugwumpin, mugwumpin.org, to for more information about Blockbuster Season being presented by the Intersection for the Arts at 925 Mission Street. I need to ask you about, again, and I know we've talked about the title Mugwumpin, but for those that aren't familiar, how did it get its... Did anything to do with the mamas and the papas, mugwumps?
I think you asked me that last time I was here, and I didn't know that. What is the mamas and the papas connection?
That was their original... They were the mugwumps before they were the mamas and papas.
Are you kidding
me?
No.
Yeah.
That's hilarious.
It's funny that you remember that. I don't even remember asking that.
Well, and sometimes people say, oh, is it a reference to Naked Lunch because there's a mugwump in there? And some people think that it's actually a Harry Potter reference. Yeah, Joe, do you want to take a swing at it?
Well, I think it comes more from an appreciation of the sound of the word more than anything. It might not be that interesting to some people, but I think you or Demo spotted the word, and it was to describe an effect with politicians not being able to make up their mind. They don't know if their mug is on one side of the fence or their wump on the other. I did hear Frank Zappa use it once in an interview when he was running for president, and he said, we have a kind of the mug-whooping effect going on.
Oh, okay.
Right. I just like to pretend he was talking about us.
But really, it has this sort of chewy, chewy sound to it that we really like, and there's something about it that also sounds very American to me in the sense that... you know, so many place names in America are these Native American words that have been sort of anglicized and taken and reshaped for, I don't know, English-speaking mouths. I know that coming from the Northeast, there are tons of places that have those kinds of names, and you see it a lot in California as well. And I think that Mugwumpin also just has that quality of chewiness and also... I don't know, the complexity of our history and our cultures in America.
Well, we'll look forward to the evolution of Mugwump, Mugwumpin, as we go forward. Mugwumpin.org for information about Chris White and Joe Estlack's production of Blockbuster Season being presented as part of the 50th anniversary of Intersection for the Arts. Again, it runs through the 18th at 925 Mission Street. Information for this particular production at Mugwumpin.org, MUGWMPIN.org. Chris, Joe, thanks for taking a little time today.
Thanks so much for having us.
Five, six, seven, eight.
Touch of All That Jazz from Chicago, which figures on Diane Keogh's cultural offerings from the peninsula. Hello once again, Diane.
Hi. The last time we saw each other, we were laughing and laughing. Remember?
Indeed.
Indeed.
That was amazing.
Well, we ought to tell them why we were laughing.
Do.
We had just seen a funny thing happened on the way to the Forum at Hill Barn, and it really was a different production, but very funny. Very funny.
It was very enjoyable.
Yeah. Well, we just played All That Jazz, which is the opening number for Chicago, which is a fabulous play. And I am so in love with what they did. I'm saying at last that there is a must-see show on the peninsula. Only if you like a clever musical satire with a great story taken from the headlines in the Roaring Twenties, and only if you like a musical show that has really stopping numbers and choreography by Fosse that is done to perfection, with singers and actors that love what they're doing, and a band that has it down to a T. Yep, I loved it, and I'm going to go see it again tomorrow night. The story, which I'm sure most of you know, is a story of two murdering femme fatales, vaudevillian Velma Kelly, who is played by Janelle LaSalle, and Roxy Hart, Elizabeth Santana, a housewife, and an ambitious chorus girl. Both of them are in jail for killing their lovers. A slick lawyer, Billy Flynn, Michael Monagle, is hired by Velma and soon by Roxy, both of whom want the spotlight, and from the opening number, All That Jazz, to the finale, the time races by with more laughs, 20 toe-tapping tunes with great lyrics, and a cast that can act, can sing, and can dance. So I suggest that anybody that wants to have a wonderful evening and enjoy it, go and see it at Palo Alto Players. It's playing until Sunday, and the telephone number is 650-329-0891. I say go see it. You'll love it. And, David, I'm a Fosse fan, and when anybody does Fosse, if they don't like, do it properly, and there is a proper way to do it, I get very upset. This one is done to perfection.
It's tough stuff to do, too.
It's really tough stuff to do, but I really enjoyed it. And I went to see another play, which is kind of interesting. It's called The Walls of Jericho. It's based on Night Bus by Samuel Hopkins Adams and produced and directed by Diane Tosca. Just think, 1934, Clark Gable and Claudette Colbert in It Happened One Night, which took all of the Oscars when it ran. It was a screwball comedy, and it's now in the new Pear Theater, a very intimate theater in Mountain View. It's the same as the Pear Theater that was on Pear Avenue, but now it has moved to La Avenida. It has more seating, and it is a brand new thing. It's all done by Diane, and it's her dream come true. And it is running at the Pear until October 4th. A very clever play, again, one without a lot of scenery, but some great acting and very interesting. So if I can talk for a minute about what's coming, and of course the Smoo-in is tonight, which is I'm going to be really excited about.
Right, down in Mountain View.
Yeah, and the Redwood Symphony is opening their season on Saturday night at the main theater at Kenyatta with Brahms, a West Coast premiere of Doherty, and Hindemith. Now, I am not at all familiar with that, but it's supposed to be really good. The number there is 650-366-6872.
It's a wonderful work. I think you're referring to the Symphonic Metamorphosis.
I am.
Yeah.
Really are you familiar
piece.
With that?
Yeah, it's a fun piece.
I'm looking forward to it.
RedwoodSymphony.org.
And the other one is Theater Works in Silicon Valley is coming up with Proof on October 7th.
Oh, right. That's part of their season.
And the one that I'm really looking forward to, because I think it's going to be fun, Notre Dame University at Notre Dame de Namur is going to present Picasso at the Lapine Agile, which is the Nimble Rabbit. And it's a story of Picasso who meets Einstein in a bar in 1904. It's running till the 18th, and I can't wait to go and see it. It should be a lot of fun. And it's written by Steve Martin, Steve Martin.
Oh, right.
Yeah. It's really going
to
be fun.
Well, look forward to that. Thanks for sharing some things happening down on the peninsula.
You're welcome.
We'll see you again soon.
Okay, bye.
Speaking of symphony openings, the opening gala of the San Francisco Symphony takes place tonight, the biggest event on the symphony calendar. Among the stars involved are the incredible baritone Nathan Gunn, as well as Alexandra Silber, and actor Kelsey Grammer will be singing some tunes, some Rodgers and Hammerstein, some Henry Higgins and Eliza Doolittle from My Fair Lady, and the symphony will also have their symphonic offerings of Respighi's Roman Festivals, which will be repeated on Friday and Saturday as their full season kicks off, with the great pianist Daniil Trivanov performing Chopin's Concerto No. 2 for piano, the Roman Festivals of Respighi, as I mentioned, and an overture by Rossini. Wonderful evening tonight as the opening gala of the symphony. Information at sfsymphony.org. And of course, Sweeney Todd continues for another performance or two at SF Opera, sfopera.com, for more information there. It's a full season of wonderful happenings here in the Bay Area. I hope I've given you a bit of insight as to some of the things happening here. If you've got a segment you'd like to suggest, drop me an email, david@kalw.org. And join me Monday evening at 9 for X explorations in music as the Alexander String Quartet and musicologist Robert Greenberg explore the last years of Mozart and his years in Vienna. That's Monday evening at 9. My thanks to Neil Swinkles for greasing the cogs of Open Air. News is next from the BBC.